Hello and welcome to the Renatus podcast. For our listeners not familiar with Renatus, we're a private equity company that provides investment capital to ambitious Irish and UK companies. My name is Greg Dilger, and it's my honour to have as our guest today Richie Boucher, the chairman of CRH, Ireland's biggest company. He is also chairman of renewable energy company Clonbio, founded by Mark Turley, as well as a director of well-known American real estate investor Kennedy Wilson, who as of now anyway owned the iconic Shelbourne Hotel in Dublin. Before all of this, Richie had a long career in banking, culminating in his role as CEO of Bank of Ireland from 2009 to 2017. Before we get stuck into it, Richie, you might just tell us a little bit about your very early life before I first came across you in Trinity College in the late 1970s.
Well, okay, Greg. My late father went out to Africa in the mid-1950s. At that time, Ireland was quite a challenged place. He was a very good sportsman, and he was lucky enough in those days and the amateur era, shall we say, in inverted commas. He got a job primarily because whom he agreed to play rugby with, and that was with a mining company. Then he met my mother. She was Irish as well. She came out to Africa. She followed him out to Africa, which was probably quite a brave thing to do, believing this guy would still be there when she arrived. And we were brought up, I'm the eldest of four boys. We were brought up in small mining towns in southern Africa. So we lived in different places. I was born in a town called Kitwe. Close to that was another place called Chilalabombwe, which is the place of the, in the Chibemba language, the place of the croaking frogs. So you remember my singing from Trinity days.
Yes, it's legendary.
So yeah, we lived there because of, it was mining towns, etc. We went to boarding school at quite an early age to a Jesuit school in what is now Zimbabwe. And I was there in boarding school till probably effectively the equivalent of fifth, sixth year.
Okay.
And then for a variety of reasons, the family were relocating to Ireland. I wanted to go to university, and so it was necessary to do the leaving certificate.
Okay.
So I went to Rockwell College in Tipperary for a short while.
Well, you've got a couple of brothers who were in a sort of similar situation, but younger.
Yeah, I've, my brothers, there's a spread of
three of them,
six years between us.
Yeah.
Surprising enough, you know, like I'm the only one of my brothers who kind of stayed in or went into corporate world and stayed.
Yes.
Each of my three brothers is an entrepreneur. They've had various of their own businesses.
Yeah.
We're all quite different characters, but yeah, we get on.
We're looking at what you're doing at the moment. Obviously, you're chairman of CRH, which by any standards is a big job. We'd love to get into it deeper, but we can't. I know you've got numbers and stuff today, so you probably have some fresh stuff that you can talk about, but just maybe tell us, it's a really big company, almost an intimidating company for someone casual onlooker. What are the big things on your board minutes at the moment? What are the big issues that you're wrestling with?
I think for CRH, it's as much the opportunities as the challenges. In fact, much more. Like sometimes people say we're the biggest company people have never heard of. You know, we have recently moved our main stock exchange listing in September of last year to the New York Stock Exchange. For strategic reasons, we are the biggest materials business in the United States. We're the biggest road builder. 75% of our business is in the United States. We employ about 50,000 people in the United States. So that was obviously a very big issue. The company has a fantastic track record and discipline about capital allocation. So as a board, we spend a lot of time on strategic positioning, the strategic footprinting of the company, the capital allocation decisions that the management bring to us. And probably the company has been quite transformed over the past 10 years under the current CEO, Albert Manifold.
Yes.
Very quietly, but very significantly reshaped the company, repositioned ourselves so that our focus is on North America and Europe, and what we've called got deeper into core materials businesses. And I'd say 10 years ago, CRH would have supplied, different parts of CRH would supply the same customer with asphalt, with gravel, with concrete, cement, etc. And increasingly now what we've focused on is bringing the entire power of CRH to as a solution to our customers. The customers might be the transport authority of Los Angeles, Detroit, etc. And say, an example in the road building, we will now work with the authority, design the road, build all the water, the bridges, etc. with them. And then we will maintain, we will have contracts to maintain that road. So it's an entire solution we bring together for our customers.
So Richie, you would have joined the board as a non-exec in 2018 or something, was it around that?
Yeah.
So in terms of getting your head around that industry, which obviously you're chairman, it's a different role to CEO clearly, but getting your head around the complexity and the nuance of the industry, how did you do that?
Well, I'd say, you know, just going to I mean, when the company rang me up and said, would I be interested in joining the boys non-exec, I kind of took a nanosecond to say, yes, I would. Yes. And they said, well, would you like to find out a little bit more? And said, no, I'm good. I'd like to join. I'd known the company from the early 1980s when I was probably assistant bag carrier to the assistant bag carrier on some of the early loans. It's a company I'd always admired. I think one of the things, though, is you always think if you're a banker or you're an investor, an analyst, you think you have insights and understandings. It's only really when you get into the company, you really understand those things that make it tick. And I suppose over my career, the things I've learned is to try and understand the basic, what's called the soft side, is the inherent culture within the company. What are the inherent behaviors and motivations of the people in the company? And I think that's one of the big things that you have to learn as a board member.
Yeah, but obviously when you're in Belgard Castle, or what it used to be, certainly, where you would maybe have your board meetings, or maybe have them abroad as well. But, you know, it strikes me as being pretty difficult to have a culture, a really clear culture, when you've got so many businesses, so many different places. And is it possible to have a kind of a CRH culture, or are you dealing with different geographies and different customs? And
I'd say that's one of the things that Albert and his management team colleagues work really hard on. Albert is extremely open with me as the chairman. There's two very large management conferences they do every year where people throughout the entire businesses are brought together, between 300 and 400 of the senior leaders in the company. And there are obviously strategic themes discussed, operational issues, but there's a huge emphasis on trying to ensure that you preserve this the entrepreneurial spirit, the feeling of empowerment, of being people running their businesses for which they're responsible, but also how does it contribute to the greater CRH? And Albert and the team spend a lot of time with their colleagues talking about the group strategy and how that group strategy
into their business.
Comes into them. And again, Albert kind of gives me free rein. I wander around, I talk to people, I sit having coffee late at night. And it is amazing how, as such a diverse group of people, different countries, different businesses, etc., there is a culture that you could describe.
That's amazing. I think that's a huge achievement.
And I would say, you know, I spent probably 8 years of my career as a banker in restructurings and workouts. And afterwards, you often reflected, you know, why does one company, you've got three companies in the same industry.
Why is one better?
Why is one better?
And stuff like that.
You probably, I say earlier in my career, I didn't appreciate as much as I now in the twilight. Yeah. You understand, it's the innate culture in a company is a huge driver of performance.
And the staff, they're conscious, like it's clearly you've made, I don't know how many acquisitions the company has made, probably thousands at this stage, but it's certainly large hundreds of acquisitions. Those companies, clearly the leaders of those companies plug into the general CRH culture. But in terms of the other staff, would they be aware that they're part of CRH and all that? Would it be?
Oh, that's it's a huge thing. So the company makes a lot of acquisitions. So, I mean, we obviously make disposals because, you know, we're always kind of, continues to ask ourselves, are we the best owners? Does this business still fit with our strategy? And there will be good businesses we will sell, but they no longer fit with how we feel we could improve them more. They don't provide platforms for growth. I think, again, one of the really interesting things is how very often we're buying family companies, particularly in North America.
Certainly historically, that was very clear. That's
still the case. You know, there are public companies in our space, but a lot of the companies are still family owned. And if I think of the current leadership teams in CRH, we have got people who came through their family companies, obviously could do a lot of different things, but they've stayed with CRH and they've progressed within CRH. And they buy into, very often a family company, the decision to sell and to whom you sell, it's not all about, obviously price is hugely important and you probably have, but there are other things that the founders who are very proud of their company or the legacy that they've inherited, they're very keen to know what's the culture of people they're buying to. And that, I think, gives us an advantage.
Does that play into the Irish-American relationship that we perceive anyway, that they like Irish people? And
I think in the early stage of the company, that did matter. I mean, Irish people they're open, they're curious, they're always interested in discussing with other people, understanding other people. I think it did help. I think also that hunger coming from a small island and trying to prove ourselves.
Yeah.
And indeed, that's one of the things that Albert really tries to reinforce within our colleagues. I mean, we're a very successful company, but he tries to have the company maintain a kind of an underdog, a scrappy mentality. Yeah.
All of these companies plug into the mothership culture. Do they effectively run themselves, or what's your general approach to running these companies in terms of their reporting into you? Do they get on with it themselves?
I think it evolves. Yeah. I mean, if you think of like our core basic materials, they're a high bulk, typically low price. So therefore, you know, there's the, once you you know, once you move gravel or concrete past 50 kilometers, transport costs overtake you.
Yeah.
Cement can travel more, but you know, it's a huge amount of it is about your local markets, your local regions, and the businesses are empowered to develop their strategy for their local regions, which includes acquisitions, which includes divestment, running the businesses. But I think what really is the transformation that has been driven is to try to keep that sense of entrepreneurial spirit, empowerment, but get the best out of being part of CRH.
Yeah.
So we provide, there are central teams who provide technical expertise. And as I touched on earlier, probably one of the bigger transformations that we're driving over the last couple of years is to bring together the different products that we can provide and bring them together as one solution to a customer, whilst preserving at the business unit level that focus on operational excellence, et cetera. Those things are very easy to write down on a piece of paper, but to evolve a culture towards that,
that's tough.
It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of thinking. And I think what I've seen is how the leadership team in CRH, they explain the why to the people in the business units, and they kind of increasingly let them think about the what and the how. But it's like, why is this important? And I think our results over the past 2 to 3 years have, in particular our margin performance, has reflected that as you provide the solutions to customers, you have a deeper relationship with the customer, you're better able to anticipate their future needs, you're able to hone your business to their future needs, and you have pricing power up and down your value chain.
And within the group, do you have a situation whereby there's internal competition for capital? Does it work that way?
Oh, no, there is internal. Yeah. There are strict criteria to achieve the capital.
Yeah.
The capital is, it's one of the things as I've got involved with the company, I did appreciate it when I was kind of from the outside looking in. But internally, the focus on return on capital, I'd say the two metrics in CRH that we most focus on internally is return on capital and cash generation. So we convert about 80% of our operating profits into cash. And that cash then enables us to give distributions to shareholders, but as importantly, to grow and develop the business. So there is a very intense competition for internal capital and a high level of criteria. Albeit over the last couple of years, I think the leadership team felt that there was something missing because of the strict rules we had on capital, the return criteria you had to get. We felt we were potentially stifling innovation, good ideas, et cetera. So the board has supported the creation of a central fund of $250 million where people can put forward good ideas, good propositions, which might not immediately meet the specific capital criteria for that particular unit, but it has the potential for applicability across the business for great through products and that. I don't think it was actually the sum of money. I mean, it's a lot of money, but I think it was the signal to people that was given is that for certain of these things, that doesn't mean that for a normal kind of part of the existing business acquisition or capital program that the criteria have been relaxed. So we're be very clear of the definition of what might qualify this fund. And I think we've also, I think very sensibly, the management team have brought in people from outside, people from private equity type backgrounds, people from early stage investment type backgrounds, because we felt if we're going to do this, it's a different skill set. So I think that's kind of some of the evolution of that thinking on capital return.
And presumably, Richie, now that you've got so big, the idea of lots of small acquisitions probably isn't really possible anymore. You probably have to be more to concentrate on bigger ones that's going to make a bit of a difference, or maybe not.
I think, again, because the responsibility for identifying opportunities is devolved down to the business units. So we will do a lot of what we would call our red bread and butter acquisitions. That's the core of what we do. And we will look at larger acquisitions. I think we've got a very, very good track record of identifying, shall we say, geographical progress through an acquisition or up and down the value chain, bolt-on type acquisitions.
Well, you get to compete with them probably for a long time.
So. I think it's like it's like sports. It's like getting football or like rugby. You got to keep the you keep the scoreboard running, and every now and then you hope you get a try or you score a goal. You know,
absolutely, Richie. Just a little question about yourself here. You've kind of moved from clearly moved from a CEO role into a sort of a chairman role quite quickly. How have you? That's a complicated transition sometimes for people. How have you managed that? Have you had to sort of change personality in some ways, or what? How has it worked?
I think you can never, the leopard can never
change
purely change the spots. But I've had to learn very, some of my colleagues who probably worked with me in different times very late in my career. I've had to learn diplomacy, influencing at a peer level, etc. I probably was quite lucky, Greg. I had the opportunity to decide when I wanted to, when I felt I'd done as much as I could with the bank at that particular point in its history.
Yeah. So you were ready.
Very few people in corporate life get the privilege of picking their own departure date. So therefore, I was ready. So I was mentally prepared to do something different.
Yeah.
I'd mentally decided I didn't want to do another CEO role, but that doesn't mean that I'd shaken off all the habits of, I've heard everyone, this is what we're doing anyway. You see, when I left the bank, I worked for about 18 months as an advisor to Fairfax, a very large Canadian
investor
insurance company who kind of have a Berkshire Hathaway model. They invest the float. And it was sobering because there were some transactions, I'd say, I think this is a great idea, guys. And they said, yeah, we heard Richie. Nah, it doesn't fit. Thanks. Yeah. Or there'd be another one. I said, I'm not sure you should do it. And they say, well, thanks, Richie, but we think there's enough upside.
Okay.
We hear the downside. Okay. We've enough upside.
Okay.
So that was quite sobering. But you actually realize you're not the boss anymore.
Yeah.
You're an advisor.
Yeah.
You have to develop different skills.
Yes.
And I think that created an appropriate, shall we say, a little bit of space between this being the CEO and then having to be a non-exec. I probably had also, having been a CEO and having had, during my time in the bank in particular, a lot of challenges, but a very supportive board, challenges from the board. So I probably got to greater appreciation. I'd say particularly the last couple of years of my, 2 to 3 years of my banking career, a lot more different appreciation of the perspective of the non-execs, etc. I would certainly say that is hugely helpful to me. And one of the things American companies do, I don't think it happens as much in Europe, but a lot of serving CEOs in American companies serve on other boards. And I think it really helps people think about their businesses, something from a different perspective, their own businesses.
Yeah.
But I also learn different skill sets and do really appreciate the value, the challenges, and how to develop a working relationship with a board. And you're able to do that because you've had a little bit of experience on both sides. And I would certainly feel that that is something.
Do you think, Richie, it's a bit of age when, as you get older, that comes on you a little bit more? I don't mean very old, but just as you get more mature.
I suppose also, as you pull yourself out of, that kind of accountability and responsibility for the operational management, et cetera. And you do, I'm lucky enough, I have a little bit of time now to, again, develop a skill of self-reflection. Reflection on, think back on what went right, what went wrong. You do have that ability to stand back a little bit. And that's where you add the value as a board member. And I think that comes a little bit with age, with experience.
Yeah.
And age and experience, but I suppose forcing some self-awareness, self-reflection, and thinking time on yourself. And as you're no longer an operating CEO, you probably have a little bit more thinking time. You're probably, you're walking on the beach or something.
Yeah.
You're thinking about something differently.
Yeah.
And you develop it.
Actually, I was going to ask this later, but what do you think makes a good non-executive? Now, you've been on both sides, been a CEO, watching them, probably maybe not appreciating some of the inputs, or maybe the other way, or now you're chairman and you've got non-execs helping you. What are the real key attributes of a good non-exec? And this would be a very interesting topic for lots of people who are finding themselves in situations like this right now.
I think the key thing is to, I feel works is if you look at it as a team. I think if you say the non-execs and the execs are kind of on different sides of the table, I think that's a problem. If you have a team, you say like we have different responsibilities, but we have the one goals and objectives in time. And therefore you're talking, the challenge is coming as more of a peer-to-peer rather than kind of a talking down or talking up, if you know what I mean.
I think historically it might have been a little bit like that, was it?
In
general, though, not in any
I think a lot
business.
Depends on your own motivations, your perceptions. So I think if you go into the role as a non-exec and you see yourself as a member of a team with a different sets of responsibilities, your most important responsibility is, have we got the right management team? And if you can convince yourself of that, then that enables you to actually focus on the things you should be focusing on, which is succession, capital allocation, reputational and governance issues,
strategy.
Mm. If you as a non-exec find yourself devoting your time to operational issues, you either have to challenge, am I being effective in my role, or is it because I don't have confidence in the management team that I'm doing that? And so I think the context you go onto the pitch is as important as how you play on the pitch, if you know what I mean.
Seeing as we're on this topic, you're now chairman. You have board meetings once a month, I guess. Is it once a month?
Well, we have formal sit-together boards 5 times a year. Okay. And then obviously we have monthly calls. Okay. And then calls as are needed on different issues.
Do you, as chairman of those, there's a bit of an art to running a good meeting and a smooth meeting. Are you conscious of a meeting that doesn't flow and a meeting that flows beautifully? And what do you think are the reasons for it?
Well, I think it's, agreeing the agenda. Mm. So again, in CRH, what we do is at the beginning of the year, we ask, instead of having, we have probably a strategy, which is a financial planning, 5-year plan, et cetera, in September, but we've moved away from that traditional 2 to 3 days, sit in a boiler room, So we have the concept of strategic themes, which are discussed. So obviously at each board meeting, you will have the operational updates, maybe capital allocation, acquisition decisions, but we'll also have strategic themes, which management will present. You might have someone externally present and the board discuss that. So I think that
educational aspect.
It's educational and understanding. So when the management are coming with saying, listen, the management come in, that will provide some kind of backdrop preparation to make sure that the board are on, obviously not the level of the, subject matter expertise the management have, but an understanding of the key issues that management are facing or the industry is facing or geopolitical issues that we are at least starting from a quasi-common platform. And then the debate and discussion is not about the facts. It's about the interpretation of the facts, the optionality that it provides, the challenges and opportunities. So I think a lot goes down to the setting of the agenda. I think a huge amount comes down to the mutual respect between the management and the board and then their respect. I mean, these are all trite things to say, but you have to work very hard outside the board to make sure that happens within the meetings, if you say. I'm a very big believer in that boards, certainly your formal board meetings, should absolutely be, unless there's something very different, in person. Because a lot is about body language.
Yes.
It's a lot about not wanting to say to a member of the management team, listen, either before the meeting or at the coffee break, saying, listen, can you help me understand this a little bit more? Because otherwise it becomes like, therefore the discussion is where someone feels, should I ask this question? Find the forum to ask the question. And if you say, listen, I'm still not satisfied, then I bring it up at the formal meeting or say, listen, one of the other things in CRH we've done, which is probably much more of an American thing. So we have a very specific set of time for what we call the non-exec session. So the board meeting, and for those to work effectively, there has to be huge trust between the management and I'd say the chair to make sure that these are focused. They're not a beat-up session, etc. But I do think it's important the non-execs have an ability to chat amongst themselves. And then the chair kind of maybe brings back some of those themes or maybe can give a different insight because as chair, you're a little bit more involved with your kind of at least weekly engagement with the CEO, etc. Saying, yeah, I can see what you're saying, but actually the way I see it is X or Y, etc.
Yeah, because I think it's certainly something I've heard over the years that non-execs can sometimes talk too much because they probably feel a need to justify their existence to some degree. And perhaps that's not because maybe they're not talking enough outside the formal board.
It is, but I would say to anyone coming onto a board and, I had to listen to it myself and take the advice myself and advice is like, you're on that board because there's been a very thoughtful process as to what type of person are we looking for. You've typically involved a search firm. You've typically talked to a few people. Yep. You've decided the type of skills, experience, diversity, et cetera, you're looking for. Mm. So I say to any of my colleagues who have joined the board, please don't
be afraid to say
don't feel you have to prove yourself. You're here because you deserve to be part of this team. Be very sure that you understand the issue because each of us is taking personal responsibility for the decisions we're taking. And feel free to contribute, but make sure that when you're contributing, it's a contribution that is thoughtful and is reflecting that you've read the materials and that you have something that you want to understand better, some insight that you've gained, more typically because of your own kind of current or past experience, etc. Or a gut feel that you might have. But to do that on the basis that you've understood the facts and that you have had opportunities and you've taken the opportunities that should be provided to you to bring yourself up to speed or say, listen, there's just something niggling. I don't want to take up the board's time, but my role as chairman is to make sure that that niggling feeling has been identified. Yeah. Talk to the CEO and say, Ida, would you help this board colleague understand where it is?
Sure.
Or would you say, you know, should have been CFO or one of the operational management team, should just talk them through it and maybe understand the perspective that non-executive board member is coming from as well.
That's very helpful, Richie, because the world we Renatus populate, these are issues to be dealt with. You know, there's boards and non-executives, and all of this stuff is played out at a smaller level or a smaller scale than what yours is. But it's very interesting to hear those inputs.
The one thing I've learned in my career, Greg, is business issues, they're the same.
Same, yeah.
You know, whether you're a company of our size or some of the other companies I've been involved with, I am involved with, you know?
I make no apologies for spending a bit of time on CRH and the governance issues. Obviously, it's our biggest company and we're lucky to have you, so we might as well sweat the asset while we have it. Just in terms of today, there's been some results and numbers out today. Just a general comment on those?
I think they're a function of the work that's been done over the past probably 10 years of transformation under the current leadership team. So I think if you look at what we've achieved, despite very volatile market conditions, that the strategic decisions, the geographies we're going to play in, the business and product lines we're going to play in, those are the groundwork. The focus on the operational excellence continue to drive the businesses. Decisions about portfolio management we've made. And I think we're really seeing the signs of that solution strategy coming together for our customers. You see in our margins, the pricing power we have, the massive amount of cash we generate, and the increased growth in returns. I think the market is, you know, that business performance is strong. Management have given the market a confident forecast of what we think we're going to achieve. Obviously, we also explain the assumptions under which we make those forecasts. And I think investors should. Well, I think it's the things that matter to us internally, which is returns, cash generation, and they drive EPS and that. And that cash, once you've got the returns, once you're remunerating the capital your shareholders have allocated, then you get cash out of that. And that cash enables us to invest in the business, to make sensible acquisitions, and also to provide cash distributions. So it all comes down to cash in the end. Whether you're CRH or whether you're a startup business, cash is the king.
You mentioned earlier, Richie, succession, how important that is. Now, it's very clear to this observer now that Albert is doing an extraordinary job there. How long more has he got in his contract, and how big is succession issue for you right now?
I mean, succession is always an issue. Yeah. Some of the things we've been working on and continue to work on is that succession is part of your job. It shouldn't be every 3 years, oh my God, we better figure out what we're going to do.
Sure.
So embedding succession throughout the company, you know, that a very significant part of your responsibility. The minute you become a leader, you have to be thinking about who could succeed me, because if I make myself indispensable, then it limits my career progression. And actually, I probably am not a great leader because I haven't developed people. So there's been a huge amount of work within CRH in seeing that succession is a normal part of policy. You have a policy of emergency succession, medium-term succession, and long-term succession planning. And have very open discussions about that. So you're doing development plans with people. You're looking at scenario planning. And everyone is saying, like, this is a normal part of life. I mean, clearly Albert is. I mean, he has energy. I find it hard to fathom how he has the energy. He has the drive.
Coming from you, that's an interesting comment.
But Albert is a core part of assisting the board in its responsibility of succession planning for the senior executive team.
Is it unfair to ask you, would you be disappointed if your Albert's successor didn't come from within the group?
I think as a board, you always, and particularly you've got your ultimate responsibility is always to the best leadership team you can possibly get for the company. You always have to do that. I think it's also an interesting process because you really are benchmarking your own people. And sometimes it's a bit like, how do you say, you know, like you pleasantly surprise yourself as the quality of your own people. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Once you benchmark your own people, you're getting increased confidence. Wow, these people are good. You have to look externally because that's a responsibility. You have to say, who could possibly be on the market? But I think the picking of the next leaders, you have to start by what's our strategy. So where are we on our strategic direction? Have we as a board and with the senior leadership team taken time back? So you're not looking for the successor who's going to be lead you through the next 2 years. It's what's our strategic objectives for the next 5 years? What do we think the external environment is going to be like? What do we think our industry's environment? So I think you have to really do that heavy groundwork on pulling yourself away from kind of immediately looking at the people you have or the people who might be on the market and saying, where do we want this company to go? I think you have to do a lot of work on the culture understand a culture and saying, is this a culture that is the right culture? Because the culture comes from generations of leadership teams. There's never the template of CEO will fit every set of circumstances. So I think you have to look at the potential externalities and some of the internal issues in the company over a longer term time period and say, okay, so what are we looking for in those leadership skills, characteristics, et cetera? And then you have to, as part of your development of your internal people, ask them to focus on some of those longer term leadership skills, strategic thinking, et cetera. And then that's what you're benchmarking externally against.
No, it's very interesting. Richie, you're also chairman of Clonbio, which it's reasonable to describe it as a renewable energy company. Tell us a little bit about what exactly Clonbio is and what problem it's solving. What the opportunity is there for Clonbio that interests you enough to be chairman of it?
I mean, I think sometimes during your career, you move away from the things you love doing best. And part of my career I really enjoyed was kind of business banking, mid-corporate banking, where very often you're dealing with entrepreneurial, family-owned companies, and you have all the dynamic and the interest that comes out of that. And through another member of the Clonbio board, they contacted me. I kind of said, listen, I'm not sure. You know, I've got a lot on. Then I met the three brothers who are the Turleys, the owners. Mark is the founder entrepreneur, and Greg and Niall are very supportive shareholders. Met them, understood the business. So our business is renewable energy. Currently, it's built primarily around ethanol, which is taking in the grain, converting it. I think what the guys have done is tremendous. And I think they're able to do this because they have belief and it's a private company. So making some very long-term investment decisions.
That's rare, isn't it?
Which enable us as a company not just to look at, really drive a true circular economy. So we take the grain, we extract ethanol from it, but we also then convert the rest of what's left over into animal feed, into different byproducts, animal feed. We've made a very significant investment that our product will be human food, verifiable, meet all the regulatory requirements for that as we explore that as an option. And also in the circular economy, we convert a lot of the energy that is happening, and including the husks and everything, we reconvert them into biomethane, which helps us drive the energy requirements of the core processes. So we've got a very, very large, probably the biggest ethanol plant in Europe. It's based in Hungary. And we are making a very significant investment now in Wisconsin. The same business with the same model. Guys, we've made investments. Typically, ethanol in the past has come from corn. We also, barley is a rotation crop. So we now have the capacity to convert barley into ethanol. That's been a significant investment in that. And we have certain other businesses, which is Slovenia, Serbia, and a joint venture here in Ireland, where we take in food waste and other forms of waste, convert it into biomethane, which typically will go into the national grid.
It sounds to me like it should be a very capital-intensive investment.
It's huge.
Clearly, the guys have money themselves. But
these are massive.
Is there any external capital in there?
No, this is the guys' own money.
It's incredible. Yeah.
It's constant reinvestment.
Yeah.
It's a cyclical business. You've got the price of ethanol is driven off the price of oil and gas, of gas, and grain, you know, is a commodity cycle. But, you know, it's impacted by weather, can be impacted by geopolitical issues, for example, the situation in Ukraine, et cetera. So these are quite cyclical businesses, and the guys have been, they've taken very little money out of it, and virtually all the capital that's come over the past 14 years has been reinvested in the businesses. And the capital investment in the businesses is well over €500 million.
It seems like the sort of business that large private equity companies would be all over, given its sector and the possibilities there. But it also seems, perhaps in time, that it could be a public company.
I think that's the optionality available to the company. I mean, the Turley brothers are very close, very tight with each other. That doesn't mean there's not discussions and, you know, quite good, you know, very good debates at the board. I think not solely financially motivated. I think it's a joy of running and investing in a business which is their own and seeing where that can bring them. But obviously, in the longer term, you're always looking, you've succession to ownership. succession to, are we able to generate enough capital internally to meet the objectives? And there are other options available.
No, it's a very, very exciting business. I can also see why they brought you in. It seems to me anyway that you, a lot of what you're doing in CRH, the big picture thinking, is very useful. It's you can take some of that thinking and bring it very easily into Clonbio and help them.
Yeah,
and their scale.
But every situation is, you know, like I said earlier, some of the themes are the same themes, but the situation is different. And what I've really enjoyed, like over the past, you know, as you move away from kind of nearly 40 years in financial services, getting involved in these different businesses, I think it's hugely, it keeps you young to be learning yourself.
Yeah.
You know, have that desire to learn. And like I'm learning every day as I get involved in these businesses. I mean, I have a good life, but I don't, like, business is my hobby. Yeah. I don't play golf. I'm getting paid to do my hobby is the way I look at it.
But, it's quite obvious, Richie, looking at you and observing you from where I observe you from, that you've got more energy sort of post your formal retirement than you had nearly when you were doing that job in Bank of Ireland.
I suppose a different type of energy.
Richie, we said at the plan was to go through your current interests and the final obvious one, and I know you have other things going on which we haven't time to get into, but you're on the board of Kennedy Wilson, which I guess at the moment, I think you've got a number of interests in Ireland. I know Kennedy Wilson, as of now, own the Shelbourne Hotel. What has been your role in Kennedy Wilson? How can you help them, and why do they want you?
Well, again, it probably came back to when we were recapping the Bank of Ireland. Bill McMorrow of Kennedy Wilson, he'd had a lot of experience in real estate cycles, etc. He was a former banker himself. He came over to buy a small business that we were selling, that we had to sell in Bank of Ireland. I met him, and he was actually the catalyst to say, I really think you should talk to these guys. I'm going to set up a call with you. Mm-hmm. And they were the catalyst for the investors. So I obviously got to know Bill.
Okay.
They came in, they provided liquidity and capital into the Irish market. And then when I went on the CRH board, Bill rang me up and said, I didn't know you were going to go on a public board.
How about another one?
Would you be interested in mine? It attracted me because it was a US board. So like I say, NYSE, I liked Bill. I'd met some of his team as real estate. So it had some kind of synergies. You know?
I mean,
Clonbio and Kennedy Wilson, they helped me with the CRH role. You know, like it's kind of, you know, it's the energy, the energy transition.
Sure.
Clonbio and real estate, obviously,
it looks like a master plan.
I would love to say that. I often say I'm the Forrest Gump of business. I think it just happened.
What kind of age is Bill McMorrow? Is he a...
Bill is probably early 70s.
Early 70s, okay.
Huge energy. So our business is primarily what we call multifamily. So it's developing and owning large-scale apartments, etc., providing those for rental. And very often, once we've, what we call stabilized, got the planning permission, constructed, rented, leased it up, then we'll bring in partners who are probably more, passive partners to come in as investors in our multifamily portfolios in particular. Mm. So we have about roughly 31,000 in the United States multifamily, and we have two main businesses. One is what is called market rate, and another is affordable. So in the US and a lot of the states, if you provide apartments to people who are on, say, for example, 70% of the median income in that city or borough, et cetera, then you get certain tax breaks. So we can either use those tax breaks ourselves or sell them into the market. So it's a very sensible way for people to incentivize this ongoing issue of providing affordable accommodation. The accommodation we provide is exactly the same accommodation, has to be the same accommodation in terms of standard, et cetera, that we're providing in what we call our market rate portfolios. Mm. So that's there in the US. Here in Ireland, we have some pretty big schemes, Clancy Quay, Capital Dock, The Grange, a number of those others, which we have bought out of the ground, developed, built them, stabilized them. We have some commercial real estate. Probably a lot of it was bought at a certain time in the cycle. We've had some very fantastic businesses. But again, what I really like about the Kennedy Wilson people is they focus on capital allocation, continue to figure out, have we bought this asset to where, you know, it's not necessary for our management skill anymore. The Shelburne has been a great investment. Kenny Wilson has made a very significant investment in it under our ownership. And I think Bill and the team thought maybe it is time that, you know, we redeploy that capital elsewhere.
Sure.
We think that Shelburne continues, will have a great future, but maybe it doesn't need our management skills. It might need a different management skill. And obviously the capital we would get from selling that will enable us to put it into our other more, our other activities.
No, you're right. Your three board positions there seem to just fit beautifully together. Like, if there was a fourth one came in out of the blue somewhere, would you be saying yes, or you have enough?
No, I think you always have to be clear about how much time you can commit. I mean, I'm very lucky. I have to create the capacity. Each of the three companies is going incredibly well. But as a board member, you always have to have capacity because there will be a challenge.
Where are your board meetings, for example, for Kennedy Wilson? Are they here?
No, they tend to be in Los Angeles.
Okay.
With CRH, there's a very deliberate policy of having one board meeting a year in North America and one in Europe, where we get to meet the local management teams. Very often we'll get management teams will do a demonstration of an investment or et cetera. So you really get to meet people, feel people. And I think that moves the board away from kind of, you know, sitting in a boardroom the whole time looking at documents to seeing real stuff and real people. And I think it does help the thinking process.
Yeah. I'm just wondering at any point, could you manage to get a board meeting down in Zambia sometime? I don't think it's likely. Richie, we'd be ashamed to have you here and not reflect back a little bit on the bulk of your career, which was in banking, your 30, 40 years, whatever it was. But it's where you made your name. And the last piece of it, as CEO of Bank of Ireland between 2009 and 2017, I think. Look, we're a good bit away from it now and you've moved on a lot. But if I was to ask you to remember the highlights and the lowlights of your Bank of Ireland CEO experience, because it was a pretty difficult time. The public perception of banks was awful. And it just, I'm sure there was loads of people in Bank of Ireland, perhaps not with skin, not as thick as yours, who were suffering through all that because it was difficult. But what's your memory of that time when you came in and briefly enough how you got through it and then decide to leave?
Very often, I think the things you remember is the people, you know? You know, moving your loan to deposit ratio from X percent to Y percent, I don't think anyone writes that in the, you know, or whatever. I mean,
on your tombstone.
I probably, going back to culture, I would say, because I wasn't a Bank of Ireland lifer, I actually only joined the company.
You were an Ulster lifer.
Three or four years. I'd worked in different banks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I inherited what I inherited. I think we had what helped me hugely was that we had a culture in a bank of people who I think it was an innate default thing was to try and do the right thing. That doesn't mean clearly, obviously, we hadn't always done the right thing, but there was people with a huge desire to do the right thing. I think the history of the bank and the tradition, because when you're a leader, you have to try and particularly if you're trying to do a turnaround, you know, I had to put into why we had to survive for reasons that would appeal to people's hearts as well as their heads. Because I was asking people, I was having to be very clear, I was telling a lot of people that, you know, what rationalization meant in human terms was people's jobs would have to go, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I had to talk about why this was important. I think it was hugely important to the senior management team and management team to reflect on the fact that this was a 200-odd-year-old bank. You know, it had been through famines, world wars, civil wars, et cetera. And, like, it was unconscionable that on our watch this bank failed. We had, I really felt hugely, it was humiliating to have to take taxpayers' money and that we had an absolute responsibility. And I was often able to articulate some of the tough decisions. The whys, because like I said, we have an ultimate responsibility. The money that's gone to this bank could be going to hospitals, schools, whatever. So we had a responsibility to pay back the taxpayers, to reduce that risk, to repay them and to reward them. And that was the three R's that I kept on emphasizing. And then to my colleagues, because you can't, you don't, you, like the bank wasn't the senior management team. It was the people in the branches, in our call centers and that. And I'd always felt the Bank of Ireland people always had a great desire, particularly in the networks, et cetera. It was the customers that mattered to them. You know, like they would think, well, you know, I'm working in the Killaloe branch. You know, that was where they focus on. And then I'm part of the West region. And oh yeah, I'm part of Bank of Ireland as well. So yeah. I really much talked to the desire for my colleagues in the, who were at the branch counters, to be able to look their customers in the eye. So why do we have to do all these things? And said, you know, there will be a time you'll be able to look your customers in the eye, and we do this to support our customers to drive the business. And, but I was very lucky that I came into a place because that culture didn't exist in certain other institutions. So I had that lucky break. And then a lot of it is mechanical engineering, if you know what I mean. You know, we had to sell businesses, we had to drive certain liquidity ratios, we had to raise capital, we had to have workouts. But we always had a belief, because we believed we would survive, we always had to believe that there was something to survive for. And that was that we had a viable bank at the end, which could do what a bank should be doing. But also, the only way we were going to repay the taxpayers is that we had an investable proposition. And investors, like they're looking to the future. I mean, they're not, as long as you can convince them that the bleeding has stopped or is stopping, then they'll say, okay, I can understand what my downside is, but I'm only going to invest if you can explain to me what the upside is. And therefore, we had a vision that if our bank survived and the Irish economy would prosper, then that was a very investable proposition, particularly where stock prices were at that time, et cetera. And we had investors who came in at that time. They had a belief in Ireland. And then,
did they have more belief than Irish people had in Ireland at that time? Probably did.
Well, it was very interesting. Mr. Ross, who was one of the investors, I mean, I kind of, like, what's your investment proposition? So I've been doing this all my career.
Yeah.
And he says, people who are in this situation, they think the sun's never going to shine again. He says, my job is to come in just before the sun does stop shining. But it was very interesting talking to the investors, the Fairfaxes, Fidelity Capital, and W.L. Ross. They started Ireland, right? Like, the bank is inextricably tied up. Ireland, do we believe in this country? It was very interesting, like they talked about. So they had sent people to just walk around the streets, and they saw the amount of young people. They studied the educational system. They studied, obviously, how the multinationals were continuing to survive and prosper. And they just said, Ireland doesn't have an income problem, it has a balance sheet problem. And they said, if you can fix the balance sheet of the country, then how do best do we play that? They were issuing, obviously, Irish government bonds, but that's like, what's the other story? And then, like a bank, clearly the bank is, a bank is a leverage exposure to an economy. And they felt the bank was a good way to play Ireland's economic recovery.
Extraordinary. Really looking back on it. It's a, and the, I always thought, Richie, you know, because at times it was the public perception. I don't know why, but I don't know, is this a global thing? But certainly in Ireland, people are giving out about banks kind of almost out of a habit. They just give out about banks all the time. They have this sort of view that banks are trying to rip them off or something. That that narrative was certainly very common around that. And you would need thick skin to sort of get on with your life listening to all of that. But clearly you had thick skin and it didn't bother you too much.
Because like I said, like if I go back to the people, because like your job is, you're the leader. You, I mean, I felt I could, like we took deliberate decisions. I said, I have to be able to face the bank. And like there was risks in that and all that kind of thing. But like, so I can't ask people to take that. I had to take, I had to be probably the lightning rod for a while. And that was important. But like, if I looked at the people we had, I would say the amount of people that I had working at different levels in the bank that surprised me and how they rose to the challenge was like, I just couldn't count them. And the amount of people who probably slightly disappointed me, I could probably count on one hand. You know? So like we had a fantastic, I felt I had a great bunch of colleagues that we had a shared goal and shared mission. So therefore I had that responsibility. I felt we'd get there. I really did believe that if we can fix some of the stuff, we'll get there. And ultimately, like I touched on earlier, like, you know, I always loved the customer side of the bank. And I said, like, you know, we survive. We can do this for our customer, we get more money. And I knew we were helping a lot of customers. I mean, obviously there were situations where we just couldn't help anymore, but we were helping a lot of customers, and we were still lending to customers who were still investing in businesses, growing, surviving. And so those are the motivations. And like I understand, you know, probably one of the experience I got, which I hadn't really got a lot of experience, is to understand the political process, is to understand the different challenges, different ways of focus are for the permanent government and the elected government. And I always had to, kind of really say, okay, can I stand back and understand where they are coming from? And I think this is always a part of any negotiation process or dealing with other people. I mean, if you go into a meeting and you spend your whole time trying to figure out what do I want to say, your whole challenge is to understand where the other person is coming from and say, like, okay, we have certain shared goals or objectives between us. There are some areas where we disagree. I know that as a journalist, your job is to kind of catch me out, but it's your job.
Yeah.
Your job is to maybe convey some anger. Okay, that's your job as a politician. You have to, and people were, people were entitled to be annoyed.
Yeah.
So people were very entitled to be annoyed.
Yeah.
And that was what, it was that, can we in Bank of Ireland really thought we could do it. And we really thought from back to, I'd say 2010, that if we can do this, then we will repay the tax or reward them. And at least if people are giving out, you say, well, okay, well, like, you know, as an investment, it's been not a bad investment. Maybe you didn't want to make that investment.
Yeah.
Maybe you could have used the money for different things at the time. But as an investment, it's been good. So you can kind of not be arrogant, but at least say, okay, well, you know, we did our job and actually you got your money back and you got a return on that money.
It's a great story, really, Richie, looking back on it. Just before we wrap up, just in terms of banking itself, and not just Bank of Ireland, banking itself, including Bank of Ireland, how do you think it'll look in 10 or 20 years' time in the light of sort of the Revoluts and all this sort of digital stuff and then the other non-bank lending stuff? What shape will they be, do you think, long term?
Well, banks are always going to be a function of interest rates. I mean, if you think of the absolute model, I mean, it's to borrow short and lend long. So therefore, banks are quite a, they're quite a complex way to play the bond market, no? So like as always, the interest rate cycle is a huge driver of banks' deposits. The investments that are made in technology are going to have to continue to be made. Sometimes, you know, I used to see business cases. I'm kind of saying like, you know, whatever, like this is a matter of survival. So the investments in technology are going to have to keep on going. People want instant access. That instant access certainly has issues for liquidity. You saw the Silicon Valley Bank as the supreme example of a bank run used to take 4 days. You know, now it takes
minutes.
10 minutes. So you have to think about your policy. But I think, you see, the last 10 years has been very abnormal. You know, it's very abnormal where you have inverse yield curves, et cetera. If you make an assumption that the yield curve is going to be upward sloping, then you can structure your deposit base differently, et cetera, et cetera. And you have those differences. So you come back to that core construction. Banks have to put more capital, both for liquidity and also for lending. And they have to price that capital properly. You have alternative lenders. That's always going to be a competitive situation. But those alternative lenders are also a function of the cycle because they're providing capital. So it's one thing to provide capital to an alternative lender when your risk-free is zero. Now your risk-free is 3, 4%. There comes a level at which the borrowers can't pay you back.
Yes.
So I think that cycle will wax and wane. The banks over the last couple of years, probably last year in particular, have made a lot of money through the interest rate cycle. But they do have to remember that the interest rate cycle will normalize and growth can only come from both sides of the balance sheet. That includes the lending side, their lending skills and experience. I think banks will increasingly become originators and securitizing some of the risk. I feel that securitizations, the originator should always have some, have a tail in the risk, some skin in the game. So that's, for example, the Kennedy Wilson model. You know, and we always say, we still have the skin in this game. You know, we haven't just offloaded it to you. When we bring in investors to the portfolios, et cetera. So I think the securitizations, there should be some concept of the originator continue to have skin in the game. Like, banks have been around us. Like, it's been around for millennia. I don't, you know, the Lord threw out the money lenders from the temple. You know, it's always again been the issue. But like, banks provide, they're an important lubricant in the economy. And they should focus on that job.
Richie, we normally do these interviews. We do them in about a half an hour. And it was unstoppable, by the way. So I have no regrets at all. We've gone on a bit longer and I'm delighted we did. Really appreciate you taking the time from your very busy life to talk to us, Renatus, and all our people really appreciate that. And we wish you best of luck in whatever you're up to. It's going to be exciting. There's no doubt about that.
That's great. And cheers.